Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning, and this is the Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me is my dear friend and co-host, Crystalline Beek Larson. Hi, Crystalline.
Hi. Welcome back.
Welcome. Yeah, thank you. Welcome to the show again, yet again. It's our Saturday morning study and exploration of the Urantia book and of interfaith concepts and ideas, and it's just great. It's great to be here. We've been doing this since 2008, so we've been doing this a while, Crystalline.
Indeed we have.
It's good to be here. It's good to share our Saturday mornings with our friends and our guests, and we hope that whatever we have to say adds something to your week. That's our intent, and that's our prayer. So God bless you all. Thanks for listening. You know, last week, Crystalline interviewed a friend, David Graves. Dave's been listening to our show since the beginning and off and on. And Dave has actually called in and shared ideas with us. He's an engineer in Ottawa, Canada. And amazing guy, Dave is. And he just recently suffered the most tragic of circumstances. Just 100 yards from his home, if even that. You know, he has a long driveway, and his son and wife were coming home and missed the driveway and slid off into an icy river. And I guess for a while, for a period of time, Dave didn't even know where they were. It was, they were presumed missing, and then it was discovered that they had gone into the river. And Dave stood and watched as they pulled the car out of the river. And his 29-year-old son and his wife, of course, both died in the accident. And he had the most amazing experience. He said, for one, he started to sing. He heard music and then realized he was singing. He was singing a Christmas...
Humming,
yeah, right. A Christmas song, right?
Yes.
Angels We Have Heard on High or something like that.
As shepherds watched their flock.
Ah, and then he said he experienced this thought that he wasn't witnessing a death event, but was in fact witnessing a birth event. And he got captured on the news media, and his faith was so inspiring that suddenly people were contacting him, wanting to talk about it. And so he came on the show last week, and I was at a meeting in L.A., and from what I understand, and I haven't had a chance to hear the show yet, and I want to, that you guys had just a great conversation.
It was very inspiring, and it was so unusual. Such a different sort of story. Not only the reaction to, you know, what must have been an emotionally devastating experience, but to find that he felt filled with joy and warmth while they were pulling the car out of the icy water. And he heard this beautiful music. He didn't know where it was coming from. And he realized it was coming from him, and he said he can't even carry a tune. So it ended up being a remarkably affirming spiritual experience for him because he felt filled with peace and warmth and joy. And he said out loud, "I'm witnessing a birth experience, not a death experience." And someone who was standing close to him had overheard what he said. And I think several people did. And he invited them to come back to his house for a cup of coffee afterward. This was late at night, like around midnight, 11 o'clock or midnight. And the one person who did come home with him happened to be a news reporter from a local television station. And he was so touched by what Dave had to say, what Dave told him, that he did a feature story, which ended up on the news.
Wow.
And he's gotten many letters and phone calls and a lot of people being really moved by what had happened to him. So it's going to be interesting to see what the long-term outcome of that is.
Well, and then in the aftermath of the show, Crystal and I talked about it, and we thought, you know, what a timely opportunity to talk about life after death, because it is really central to every religious belief, and it is the core of why people reach out for religion in the first place. This is the one mystery of mysteries. The one thing that we have to have faith about. And there's really no way around it. And yet it's inevitable, right? It happens to every single one of us. I don't think any of us can point to any human being who hasn't died. That has lived here in the long history of this planet and humanity on this planet. Every single human that has lived here, has been born here, has also died here. And so it is a reality that we all face, our own mortality. And to me, philosophically, I've asked myself this question many times, and I throw this out there to you, Crystal, and to our listeners. And by the way, if you want to give us a call and share your experience with us or your thoughts on life after death, we welcome that. The phone number is 646-716-8158. But here's my reasoning on this. I've thought about life and death quite a bit, and I come to the conclusion, ever since I was very small, that there is life after death, because it just doesn't make sense otherwise. Nothing that's happening here makes sense if this life is all for naught. If we're a cosmic accident, which many scientific people like to, you know, and will come right out and say, oh, that near-death experience you had, that's just your mind shutting down. And, you know, these doctors that say that they experienced, had a life-after-death experience, you know, they've just fooled themselves, and there's really no life after death. And, you know, we're just a big cosmic accident.
Well, as my dad said, it's actually rather arrogant to either believe there is no God or to believe there is no afterlife, because you can't possibly know that there isn't.
Right.
You would have to know everything in order to be certain that there is not.
Well, and if we're going to speculate, it's just as equally, it's equally a speculation to say there isn't as to say there is. You can't, just as you just said, you can't know. So if we're going to look at life for what it is, we're going to say, okay, I was born and I learned, because of the love of my family and my parents, how to walk and how to talk. And then I went to school and I was educated. And I grew up and I learned many lessons in life. And every person, every human being has a unique experience. No two humans, even if they're from the same family, have the exact same life experience. Everybody is absolutely unique. Because each person, even Siamese twins, they've had to go through life stuck together. And yet, because of their own unique viewpoints, they experience life, whatever it is they're experiencing, in a unique way. Okay, so we've gone through this life. We've learned all these lessons. We've achieved many things. We've achieved relationships and careers and education, and we've raised children, and we've acquired wisdom and knowledge, or knowledge and wisdom, more correctly in that order. And that's all for naught? That all just goes away when you die and is gone, poof, gone. It means nothing? Where's the logic in that? How can we possibly believe that? That we've gained all that we've gained in this life, as intense as it is, as short as it is, as meaningful as it is, and it's all for naught? I don't buy it. I've never bought it. And so, you know, my first experience with death was when my dad died when I was 20 years old. And my dad was one of these people who brought so much value to everyone else's life. He brought love and wisdom and kindness and patience and loyalty, sympathetic understanding, strength, passion. He brought so much into the lives of those who loved him that when he left, it left this big hole. And I personally had to understand that this life that meant so much to me had meaning and purpose and value and went on. And that started my search in earnest for the answer. I always had faith in God. I always believed in God and angels. I've always felt the presence of angels. And this was, you know, and I've always felt the reality in the presence of Jesus Christ and his Spirit of Truth. But I didn't know for sure where my dad was. And I wanted specifics. And I started praying very hard for those things. And my whole family was just grieving so badly that not one of us could offer comfort to the other. And I had to look outside of my family. And the Urantia book came into my life. And I just knew this book is the answer to my prayer. I didn't know how or why, but I knew that it was. And ironically, it contains the most amazing and compelling story of what happens to us after we die. And it just makes so much sense.
That's really it, isn't it, too? It just makes so much sense. I think that's one of the most compelling aspects of the information in Happy Rancher book is people read it and they say, you know, it just confirms something that I always felt must be true.
Right.
And as for the concept of the Ascension program, Ascension plan, I think it's even more than most people could have imagined. It's
way
so much
more.
Better than most of us could have imagined.
This whole idea of ascension, you know, just one concept. Just take one concept from the Arantia book. Your body is held to this planet by material gravity. Yeah, we all know that. However, your spirit, your soul, is drawn upward by the spirit gravity of the universe, which pulls you from the center of all things where God himself resides. And that spirit gravity is going to take you back to paradise. And you don't, your soul, your spirit has intrinsic value and eternal value. And it will go on. Your body is just a vehicle for that. And it's only a vehicle in this one short life. And then you ascend and you move on to the next life. And it describes that ascension in tremendous detail. I was telling Krystalyn earlier, I'm sorry Andre can't be with us today because he has such a grasp on the ascension. He just knows the details. So I invite some of you readers out there, if you if you want to come and channel Andre with us and be with us with your wonderful knowledge of the details of the ascension career, as the Arantia book calls it. But Krystalyn, you picked out a quote, a really good opening salvo for us.
Well, I also wanted to share, before I read the quote, I thought I'd share my first experience with the Arantia book as a child was following the death of my baby brother, who was born severely deformed after my mother had been treated for tuberculosis during her pregnancy. And the medication she was on was later found out to be really, really devastating to pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So he only survived a very short time after he was born. But it was a really devastating experience for the family. Both my brother and I were really grieving the loss
of
our anticipated. I was 6 and my brother was 4. And or almost 6, I guess. Anyway, that spurred our asking the question about what was death, what happens after we die. And my dad gave us this amazing introduction to the concepts in the Arantia book. He had just gotten the book and read it himself within the last year. So it was very timely. And I know many of our listeners who've heard this story before, or friends who have heard me tell this. I apologize for being redundant, but I'm going to tell it again. My dad said that life and death was this tremendous universe adventure of discovery and unlimited opportunity. The opportunity to fulfill all the true dreams of our heart. And there was nothing and no one who could ever interfere with our launching off on that plan, except for we ourselves, that it was a friendly and free will universe. And this good news was for everyone of faith who wanted to go on. Would have that opportunity. And he just made it sound like the most amazing adventure. And he also really emphasized things, you know, like it's going to take a lot of tenacity, a lot of courage, optimism, trust, faith, you know, the value of our relationships, because they would go on, they would be something we could take with us, and that all of our most vital spiritual experience, all of our experience of value would go with us, with our memories. And that we would actually be traversing the universe, heading to paradise. And it was just an amazing story. And we were both hooked from that point on.
Well, it just goes back to this idea that you, you know, you have to be able to answer this question. Why am I alive? And what value does my life experience have? And is it all for naught? And if it's all for naught, what makes any of us want to stick around and live? Because obviously, life is challenging and difficult. And yet, it's rewarding and joyful. And so, what value, any tool in your tool bag that you won't ever get to use? Like an experience, the experience of life. What value does it have if you'll never get to apply it?
And as I was discussing with a close friend recently, you know, we get old so much faster than we get wise. That there must be life after death, just for that reason alone.
Well, and we know that people, you know, I have to ask myself, what is this resistance to the notion? I know that we feel like cosmic orphans on this planet. We do. You know, if the spaceship showed up tomorrow en masse and we realized, oh, okay, so we're not alone in the universe, that would be a big classic paradigm shift for all of us. However, when you ask most people, I think 60% believe that there is life in the universe. So most people believe we're not alone. And, you know, this whole classic question of God and creation and life. I like to, you know, because it's interesting to me because we have no physical empirical proof of life after death. We think it doesn't exist. Because we have
no... And
what kind of proof... Yeah, what would it take?
Would it take? I mean, other than the resurrection of Jesus, which more than 500 people witnessed, enough to make it a relevant historical bit of information as any as relevant an historical fact as anything else in history has been. Other than that, what proof do we have? I mean, what proof do we need? What proof could we have?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what proof we could have except something that is so evident. It's just so evident that there is something greater than we see. And that our sense of sight, our senses, our physical senses, are filters for a greater experience. And, you know, other than personal experience, and you're pondering this in your own heart, what is the meaning of life and death? I love the analogy of birth because, and somebody told me this years ago, and I've always remembered it. Imagine a child in the womb, in utero. Everything is provided. It's a nice, neat, contained little existence. And the child in utero is only conscious of that existence and that experience. There's maybe muffled sounds from the outside world, but the child knows nothing of that world. It has no experience with that world. All it knows is it's comfy, cozy, and everything I needed is all provided right here, right now, in this little space that contains me. But unbeknownst to the child, very soon it will go through a total transformation into a new realm. And that is birth. And all of a sudden, imagine how traumatic that must be to realize that your environment is rejecting you and pushing you out. And you have no choice in the matter. You're just being pushed out into the unknown. And imagine, after having gone through this process, what space, what it's like to reach out and not feel anything containing you. My little daughter, Jean, when she was born, I would walk into her, you know, as she was sleeping in her crib, and I'd walk up to her, and she'd throw her arms out in both directions, just throw them out, like she was reaching for something there. She wanted to feel that space. She wanted to feel that enclosure, but it was gone. All that was there now was space. And I used to think, wow, what a shock to her, to a little baby, to not have
Well, you
that
know,
space.
They say that it really comforts newborn infants to be swaddled really tightly.
Right, right.
Because that's what they're used to.
And little kids love to crawl into a box or a little dark, you know, nook and curl up in a little ball.
And even animals and other... And they say people with autism and other kinds of anxiety often will get a great deal of soothing comfort from being held really tightly.
Right. So here's the next step. And we all are going to, just like every child in utero will be born, I went 3 weeks overdue with my son Nathan, and my friend, who was a smart aleck, told me, "Don't worry, Paula, these cases usually do terminate." I'm like, "Well, thanks, Tim." When you're 3 weeks overdue, that's kind of like, you know, well, at least he made me laugh, right?
But indeed.
Here we are, all are, getting ready for this next birth into the next reality, which is probably, which we know, it will be as different to us from this reality as that in utero reality is different from the world we're living on right now. And it's just the next step.
Well, let me go ahead and read that quote that I was going to start with. It's from paper 103, section 5. Paragraph 7, and it starts, "The pursuit of the ideal, the striving to be godlike, is a continuous effort before death and after. Life after death is no different in the essentials than the mortal existence. Everything we do in this life, which is good, contributes directly to the enhancement of the future life. Real religion does not foster moral indolence and spiritual laziness by encouraging the vain hope of having all the virtues of a noble character bestowed upon one as a result of passing through the portals of natural death. True religion does not belittle man's efforts to progress during the mortal lease on life. Every mortal gain is a direct contribution to the enrichment of the first stages of the immortal survival experience."
So essentially what this quote is saying is not only does what we experience here go with us and carry on, but also, and it says it in another place, death adds nothing to us. We don't die and become perfect.
There's another place where it says we also start off right where we left off.
Mm-hmm. So this concept of, you know, in some of the great religions of the world where you die and you are perfect, you die and suddenly death has made you perfect. That's not true either.
And you're sitting at the hand of God.
Mm-hmm.
Or at the foot of God.
Death did nothing except contribute to the fact that you realize you survived it. And that has to be pretty amazing. To wake up in the next realm and realize, oh, hey, wait a minute. I still am. It's me. I'm here. I still am. That's got to be a pretty powerful realization. We have a caller, and it's our great, wonderful friend and listener, God's Gumshoe.
All right.
Hey, Gumshoe.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi, Paula. Good morning, Kristen. How are you guys doing today?
Just great.
Yeah, I'm so glad you called.
I just thought I'd lend my voice if there's anything I could contribute. I think, as you know, I was in ministry for a number of years and chaplain, a hospital chaplain, and so this is a subject that I've had a great deal of experience and challenge with throughout the years of ministry. And it's so close to everyone because everyone knows someone who's passed along, and it's at that time when all of the questions arise about is there or isn't there, and there's always something within us that hopes that there's life after death, and there's always this question that no one has definitively put a statement or put a proof on it, and so it's the most challenging thing that we face, both when a loved one goes and then when it's our turn, because as you said, nobody's making it out of here alive.
Yeah, and I imagine in your many years of ministry, you've had so many occasions to try to help people with this concept.
Yeah, in fact, that's been the thrust of most part of my ministry, although I never really expected it. I always thought that my father always told me that I was born with the gift of the gab because we're Irish, and I always thought it would be that I would be the preacher, right, or the teacher, right, and it just as the universe would have it, the tables turned on me. And pastoral chaplaincy was a big part of my ministry, and it is. The people who need the help the most, of course, are the families. They have the questions, and each and every one depend. And in chaplaincy, of course, we're treating people of all faith. It's not just a Christian belief. Muslims and people from the Hindu faith and Buddhists, they have their faith, and as a chaplain, it's our job to know what that is and to be able to treat that with the dignity that their faith deserves and requires. So it's the most challenging, but I think that one of the things that when we talk about the process of end of life, whether it's a long, drawn-out, painful process or whether it's sudden in an accident. The most painful, of course, is the death of children. It's always helpful for the family and for each of us to know that there is something and that we just don't know what it is yet. We just can't put our finger on it yet. those who have a faith and are strong in that faith usually fare better than people who don't. I know people who have either have no faith or have lost the faith, don't believe, and a death has completely destroyed their life and continues to, years and years later. So what we find is that people who hold to some sort of an understanding of the ascension program or the reincarnation or anything that is there for them that they can grasp onto is a tremendous assistance at that crucial moment, at those crucial times. And there are cultures who not very many still, but ancient cultures who actually death was a celebration, a passing to the next world. And I think that that's in essence what the Urantia papers, I've been as a gumshoe, as a detective, I've been investigating this for nearly 40 years, and I'm persuaded that this particular document is what it claims to be, and it is the best explanation for a human operator's manual that we've ever been given. And that in the explanation of the process of the universe, of training and educating us, that process is the most profound activity in this section of the universe. That the ascension program, the majority of the resources of the universe are aimed at that particular aspect of universe activity, and that we know that intuitively. We know that there's a psychologist. I'm sorry, I just can't. I know that he's kind of a comes from the stream of Jungian or Carl Jung. I can't remember his name right now, but he has a great book out called Fast and Slow Thinking, and basically he says that the human mind, we can look at the human mind in two systems. We have system one, which is our quick thinking. So if we say to someone, "What's two and two?" Well, automatically four. It's an automatic process of four comes right to us. But if we ask, "What is 17 times 131, all of a sudden we have to, we've got to slow down and we have to start this calculation of system two.
Mm-hmm.
And system one, when it can't solve a problem, it makes a story. And most of our ancient peoples functioned along the system one mindset. And as a quote from the Urantia paper said, it's sad to record that so few people delight in cultivating system two thinking, which when we pause into the deep thinking, we have built in within us in the human mind system, an aspect of the cosmic mind system that recognizes that there is a continuation. And this is the basis of the stories of heaven and the stories of reincarnations and the stories that we have created around what we know to be true. And so this intuitive sense is what when we move into the deep thinking and the deep problem solving of this. I mean, there is no system one and system two. He makes that clear. But for the purposes of discussion, we begin to understand that the majority of the human mind system functions along the system one. We just want a quick answer, and if we can't find one, we'll fill in the blanks as far as we can. But when we go into this deep thinking, and even into the meditative aspects of life, we touch on that intuitive sense. The Urantia papers tells us that we have three sort of cosmic intuitions that come in our mind process in this inner world. We're all very conscious of our outer world. We look after our body. We know where the heart and the lungs We know what to do with the skin. We know what we need to put on it. We know the outer world very well, but most people really don't cultivate a recognition of the an understanding, a deep understanding of the inner world and how it is made up of the conscious, the unconscious, the conscious or the subconscious, the superconscious. And at the Answer Papers tells us that we have these three cosmic intuitions that come as, in essence, part of our reality response to recognize this, the reality of the universe. And that's what makes us a step in consciousness above the animal world.
Right.
So we have these three that help us to understand the facts of reality, the mind aspect of reality, and the spirit aspect of reality. And we eventually those grow and develop into science, philosophy, and religion. But also the human element has kind of created their own assumptions around each of these bodies of knowledge that we've come from these three cosmic realities. But this cosmic reality, that this reality response tells each and every one of us that there is something after life. There's and when we cultivate a deep problem solving look into there, the more that intuition comes forward and comforts us, and comforts us particularly in this time of end of life. Well, there's my two cents about that. and also, I mean, if there's something I can help with the Mansion Worlds, with the Ascension Program, I'm not Andre, that's for sure. Boy, he's got it down. But if there's
yeah, I know that. I mean, he'll just rattle it off. But can you state again what the three cosmic intuitions are?
I think that they're identified in the papers early in the paper. I think it's paper 16 or somehow that seems to stick with me. But they talk about the three cosmic realities that come in the our mind, the human mind system, and they are dealing with causation or cause and effect is the first one, and that allows us to see now cause and effect. And from that, we can grow and develop to see that the world, the facts of the world. So if I hit my hand with this rock, it's going to hurt. And in that we're able to kind of see that we can look before we leap, and understand what will happen before we leap, kind of thing. So there's causation. The second one comes it's identified as duty, but morality, about recognition of right and wrong. And so that's kind of one of the mind, the aspects. Right and wrong doesn't appear in nature. It's not a human construct, but it's a human concept. And then the third one is... it comes from the worship response, and basically helps us in the recognition of the spiritual aspect of the universe.
Well,
and
if you'll allow
there,
me to read it,
we've grown our own religious ideas about that. Sorry, Kristen.
If you'll allow me to read, it's from paper 16, section 6.
Other.
It says, "In the local universe, mind bestows these three insights of the cosmic." In the local universe, mind bestows. These three insights of the cosmic mind constitute the a priori assumptions which make it possible for man to function as a rational and self-conscious personality in the realms of science, philosophy, and religion. Stated otherwise, the recognition of the reality of these three manifestations of the infinite is by a cosmic technique of self-revelation. Matter energy is recognized by the mathematical logic of the senses. Mind reason intuitively knows its moral duty. Spirit faith, parentheses worship, is the religion of the reality of spiritual experience. These three basic factors in reflective thinking may be unified and coordinated in personality development, or they may become disproportionate and virtually unrelated in their respective functions. But when they become unified, they produce a strong character consisting in the correlation of a factual science, a moral philosophy, and a genuine religious experience. And it is these three cosmic intuitions that give objective validity, reality, to man's experience in and with things, meanings, and values.
Man, that is a great quote.
It almost completely
synthesizes the art of living and philosophy together in such an eloquent paragraph.
It is.
And the more time you spend with this information, as we know, the more sense it makes, and the more, you know, you can't, I love this concept that you can't dwell wholly on one or the other. Life is not just science, the study of material fact. Life is not just religion, the desire to reach out and understand the unknown and the unseen and deity and divinity. And life is not just philosophy, which is the correlation of those two.
Yeah.
Life is all three.
Well, you know, the Baha'is have an interesting expression that they say that that human life is like a bird that flies on two wings, the wing of science and the wing of religion. That if you should lose the wing of science, for instance, humankind would spiral down into a den of superstitious totalitarianism that would be just outrageously horrible. If we lose the wing of religion, we would spiral down into a secular totalitarianism that is equally as horrible.
Right.
But that we fly on this philosophy of the harmony of science and religion, and that keep works as the rudder, as the tail that steers us into truth and to the recognition and the understanding of truth. And that's mostly, I think, what the Urantia papers are saying to us, is that the harmonizing of science and religion brings forward a living philosophy, and that it's not about the language of religion, but it's our own deep personal experience that we have mind to mind with the cosmic mind, with God, with that presence that's in the universe, whatever word we're, God, Goddess, higher power, spirit, whatever word works for each group, individual, and it's that personal experience. And that all religion is just language about trying to describe what that is.
Well, I think it's also... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
I think it's interesting that one of the things that the Urantia book does is it gives us some new language that helps us with new conceptual frameworks that didn't exist before in other philosophical tool chest, so to speak.
Yeah,
there's another
yeah.
quote from paper 103 where it says, "Your difficulty in arriving at a more harmonious coordination between science and religion is due to your utter ignorance of the intervening domain of the Urantia world of things
right.
and beings."
Our soul world.
Right.
Our soul world.
The
right.
local universe consists of three degrees or stages of reality manifestation: matter, Urantia, and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
The Urantia angle of approach erases all divergence between the findings of the physical sciences and the functioning of the spirit of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is pretty crucial here. And I'm hoping that we'll get an opportunity to share some more with our listeners about what the Urantia book says about the Urantia stage of things, what the Urantia worlds are like, and what kinds of things and activities and functions they offer for us.
Right.
Because there really is no other resource that I've ever found. And if anybody knows of one, let me know. But
mm-hmm.
I've never found anything that offers as clear a description of what the immediate life after death lifestyle, if you will be like.
Well, I think that the in all of my years as an investigator into truth, and as all my years in ministry, and I have never come across anything, and in our particular seminary, we study all of the world's religions, never come across anything that says it so completely and so definitively as these papers. But it's not something that you can dive in and go, oh yeah.
What do you mean
truth.
It's not something you can dive in?
The Urantia papers, that you can just dive in and go,
right.
Oh, yeah.
It
well,
takes
this,
a lot
this
of
is,
study.
Yeah.
Patience.
So what I see and what I see happening is that those of us who are students and are able to help to condense, I mean, we have to draw on metaphors and similes and language that helps those who are just getting started to understand that what this paper is presenting is the truth of the universe. There is a truth. One group says it's this, one group says it's that. What makes the Urantia papers any different than any other group who says their truth is truth? But when you once start in there and you discover a truth that really rings your truth bell, really hits, you go, boy, that's really, and as you follow it, you follow more and more along the lines of something keeps ringing your bell.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you recognize this thing is talking some serious truth here, that when it goes into those things that we could not possibly know about the next world and the world after that and the world after that, because the truth that you already know is true rings for you, it's easier for you to begin to understand that this universe is an incredibly complex but incredibly wonderful home. And that the way that the papers forms it and shapes it has got to be the right way, because that's just the right way, and it rings that way. So when they talk about the mansion worlds, I mean, the mansion worlds is our next step. That when we leave this world, we arrive in the mansion worlds, which are training worlds. They help to take us from the material beings into the one day, sometime in the future, spiritual beings that we will be, and this stage in between that Crystalline used the word Urantia, is our growth period. It's kind of like our kindergarten, and we move into that and grow in character, grow in values, and grow deeper in our intellectual and spiritual and the wholeness of life, not just one aspect of it, not just the spiritual aspect or not just the intellectual aspect of it. And the universe
well,
is made
are.
Up of that whole teaching process all the way along until one day you make it. One day you've arrived at the spiritual being that you are meant to be.
Right,
and we are
metamorphosing. You know, I mean, I can't think of another word to describe it. Just
That's right.
Like if we look at that pattern again, that same pattern of the child in utero, it starts out as a single cell, and
yeah.
then it divides. How like God? How
yeah.
like the Father, the Son, and the Infinite Spirit? He started out as a single entity and then divided again. And we develop from one, you know, it's the causation that creates life. And now all of a sudden you have an embryo, and this embryo is becoming conscious, and this embryo is evolving hands and feet and a brain and a nervous system and a digestive system and a vascular system. This embryo is becoming a complex living creature. But it started as a single cell.
Yeah.
It started actually as an ovum and a sperm. And look at what a miracle that is. And a woman carries that in her body, and then she brings it forth upon this world. And she nurtures it again, yet again, because it's not capable of surviving on its own without her help. And
right.
his help, his its father's help. And so now it grows, and it learns to walk, and it learns to talk, and it becomes more and more and more complex. And it's throughout the course of its entire life, evolving, changing,
right.
growing, and creating. And look at us. You know, you gave the example of the two wings.
Mm-hmm.
We have two eyes that we see the world from, and we have two hemispheres. One is creative and one is logical. We don't just have one. And if we did just have one, we would be at a great disadvantage, because we have the two. We can see both sides,
right.
But we have these two sides that look at the world from two eyes that unite and create focus and harmony out of what we see. But I'll take it one step further. We have a third eye that looks back upon us. Two eyes to look out on the world, and the eye of God looks back on the inner life. And I don't know if through your meditations you've ever seen the third eye. Transcendental meditators talk about seeing it.
Yeah. Well, that's I first learned that about 40 years ago when I was first coming into the seeking and searching for truth. I was introduced to a transcendental meditation, and while I really loved that technique, I really had this resistance to the ceremony and to much of the ritual. But I've always used that technique, and I've always used that as meditation for me is, and my mind is what most people do with a toothbrush and their teeth. It's something you do every day, and it really helps to keep that whole third part of you, that superconscious mind and the conscious mind connected. Because I think the superconscious mind came again from Dr. Carl Jung, but It's such an incredibly good word, primarily because the word God has so much baggage with it to every group. But when we talk about the superconscious mind as that higher part of us, we all kind of ring with that. We can ring the recognition of that.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can expand the idea that the superconscious mind is the cosmic mind, it's present everywhere in the universe, and it carries us to the next level and to the next level and to the next level, in an infinite journey, an eternal journey, a never ending journey of growth and discovery and experience.
And that brings me.
We can sense it right here, right now. And all we need to do is to ask.
Right.
Ask, and you shall receive. Knock, and the door will be open. Seek, and you will find. Those profound words from the ancient teachers are exactly the truth. That it's not really about a book or any writing, but that experience within. And all you need to do is ask. If you ask, you will know the truth.
Well, and here's a classic example, and I posted this with the blurb. And then if you like, if you're going to hang in here with us, Gumshoe, which we would love,
to just talk about some of the basic concepts of where we go, what happens after we die. But this quote to me is just so thought-provoking, and it's one of those zingers. You were talking about truth earlier, how it rings your bell, and once you had your bell rung, you know what it feels like to have your bell rung, and your truth bell. And it becomes easier to recognize the truth when you hear it. The more you hear the truth, the easier the truth is to recognize. And, of course, Jesus said that it will set you free. But this is from paper 14. It says, the central and divine universe, it says, love of adventure, curiosity, and dread of monotony. These traits inherent in evolving human nature were not put there just to aggravate and annoy you during your short sojourn on earth, but rather to suggest to you that death is only the beginning of an endless career of adventure, an everlasting life of anticipation, an eternal voyage of discovery.
That thrills you. I mean, that just brings goosebumps.
Me too. So what happens, Crystalline and Gumshoe? What happens when you die? What? First of all, what makes you real? And then, when you die, how does that reality go on?
Well, let's start with just sort of the real basics of what the Urantia book has to say about life after death. The first thing it has to say about the significance of spiritual growth is that the only thing required for spiritual growth is our free will interest in growing spiritually, in faith, in our faith. Our belief in something greater than ourselves, that the very first moral decision that we make as a young child will signal the arrival of that still small voice that is talked about biblically, or the thought adjuster, or the mystery monitor, as it's referred to in the Urantia book, but that Spirit of God which comes to dwell within our mind and has the capacity to guide us forward as that spiritual gravity that Paula was talking about, towards paradise, towards God himself. First, the first source and center, our creator. And that faith is all that's required to create the glue that begins to coordinate our personality, our soul, our spirit, and our mind. And all we need is the slightest flicker of faith is apparently enough to provide that glue of keeping us together in some, or to make us reassemblable. That's not a word. to give our angels or our Urantia beings the capacity to recognize us or to deal with us, you know, as a reborn being, a resurrected being.
And I think I'm sorry, Kristen, but I think that deserves a pause at that moment, because I think that's a crucial point is the smallest flicker. I don't remember where I picked this up, but a saying that I've used often from the pulpit was, the smallest act of kindness causes your angels to sing.
Mm.
And when I think that the smallest flicker of faith causes your angels to sing, is all that is required to get you across that line, to get you to the other side. Whatever that other side is, we will discover when we get there. And the
Right, and to clarify, too,
does a beautiful job.
to clarify, too, that the Arantia book does not designate faith as a faith in a particular religion.
That's right.
Okay, or in a particular conceptual framework.
Yeah, right.
It just
exactly.
means faith.
Yeah.
And
right.
so that in and of itself is pretty good news.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, for the majority of people who've had a difficult time with believing a specific religious concept that they find either nonsensical or, you know, that just does not resonate for them. It's a great relief to hear that we're not expected to believe in something that doesn't make sense in order to survive this death experience.
And another thing that I think that is important that the Urantia papers point out is that when you lose consciousness on this side and then you wake up, there may have been 2,000 years of Earth time go by, but you will not know that or experience that. To you, it's been, you closed your eyes and you opened them again. There's no realization of a time.
Well, they say it feels like falling asleep at night and waking up in the morning,
yeah.
where you don't really have any sense of how much time has transpired.
Yeah, right.
And you may have slept for quite a while, but
right.
you won't know that there's no cognizance of time having passed. And so
and
you wake
one of the
up,
most important things about the waking on the other side is about relationship. That the whole of
right.
the universe is about relationship, and that the relationships that you've made here will be continued, and you will be known, you will know and be known. It's not like you merge into the ocean like a drop of water. You are an
right.
individual.
You still retain your own personality, and you're
yeah.
still recognizable as that personality.
Right.
And the first experience that you will have when you wake up is that you will be greeted by your friends and family who have gone on before you.
Right.
And the first recognition that you probably will have is just the recognition or the awareness that you've woken up.
Yeah.
You know, that death was not the end for you and that there you are.
And there you are, that's right.
Then we're told that we have a 10-day vacation, basically. 10 days of free time to explore our new surroundings, to get used to our new body. We are told that the concept of the resurrection of the body, this earthly mortal body, is not accurate. We don't get
no,
this
we,
one
we
back
don't
again.
Drag this thing along with us.
We don't drag this one along with us.
Thank God.
Which I'm very relieved to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
And
a good biblical example of that, by the way, is Jesus when he was resurrected and he said to Mary Magdalene in the garden, "Touch me not, Mary, for I am not as you knew me." We know from reading the Urantia book that he was actually in that body of the other side. The
Urantia
body.
Urantia form.
Right. And he, I think, he asked her not to touch him because it would have frightened her. Not
yeah.
because it would have harmed her in any way, but because he was not substance as we know. Urantia, if you look up the etymology of the word, essentially means akin to matter, like matter, not matter.
Like, not matter, but like it.
But like
right.
it. And so
yeah.
something, you know, had she touched him, perhaps her hand would have passed through, or perhaps something, you know, it would have been shocking to her. So I think he warned her because he didn't want her to be frightened.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
yeah,
a good
yeah.
example, biblically, that we don't wake up in the same body. If we did, he wouldn't have told her, I'm not as you knew me. He wouldn't have stopped her at all because he would have been exactly as she knew him. But he wasn't.
So what else happened? What else does the Urantia book say happens?
I think it also tells us that our new body is refined to Korah.
Yes, let's talk about that new
body.
Let's
talk about that.
That is such a cool thing. And it goes into such great and glorious detail about that new body. That
I want a Lamborghini type kind.
Well, let's talk about the details of the new body.
Well, we have, 70 senses. Imagine that. 70. So it's almost like, and Joanne, my dear friend who is my associate here at the Urantia Book Fellowship, who sponsors our show, by the way, said the other day, I think that the spiritual reality, the material body in a way filters a lot of spiritual reality. It actually protects us from overstimulation or over input. And so these crude human material filters that we have actually keep us grounded and sane in a way, because we're not able to deal with the input that would be coming in if we didn't have this filter of this body. So let's imagine that for a minute, that some of the filters that stop us from sensing the spirit realm and other realities are removed now, and we're experiencing 70 times as many realities.
I think it's very important for us to understand, because when we understand the process of evolution, and we understand that we are an animal, a spirit being in an animal body having a spiritual experience here, our animals are fear-based. And if we didn't have these filters, and oftentimes you see this in the people have these horrific visions of ghosts and demons, and I mean Hollywood doesn't help at all, but that if the universe wasn't filtered, that fear base would drive us insane.
Right. It would. What were you going to say, Crystalline?
I don't remember. yes. Okay, I do now.
See, it comes back.
The one of the ideas that comes to mind for me is, let's say we have the ability to telecommunicate or to read each other's minds. One of the things we're told is that that's another topic, but maybe if that was one of the additional senses that we had, imagine all of the static, all of the noise, all of the, you know, everything we would hear, if we could hear what everybody was thinking.
Wow.
Instead of just what people were saying. And what comes to mind, I don't know if you've seen that movie, What Women Want, with Mel Gibson, where he has this freak accident, he gets electrical shock, and all of a sudden he can hear what women are thinking. And in one of the first scenes, he's walking down the street, and he's just hearing everything, even what the dog is thinking as she's bounding by. He's just hearing all these different people's thoughts, and it's just this cacophony. And so that's one idea. And I think about the way that my skin feels when I have a fever.
Mm.
And when it feels like almost every hair on my body is sending separate, you know, signals. I can feel the sheet on my skin, or I can feel the air blowing by, because I'm hypersensitized.
Right.
You know, those are some of the examples I think of as probably what it might be like. I'm assuming it's not a painful experience, but I would bet that it's going to take some getting used to.
It's no doubt a shock to see spirit beings. And the Urantia book tells us that if our eyes were anointed, and we know that in special dispensations they have anointed various humans to be able to see and witness various things, just like the three apostles witnessed Father Melchizedek and Gabriel speaking to Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. Under certain dispensation,
in special circumstances, humans have been allowed to see the spiritual realm. But, and it says, if our eyes were anointed or, you know, tuned up, let's just say our eyes become like microscopes, and now all of a sudden we can see the microscopic world. It would be like that. Suddenly, and imagine just that, if your eyes were like microscopes and you could see dust mites. Which looks
somehow
like
somehow we don't seem to be able to come up with positive images.
You know, I think Chris Halverson calls it the super additive consequence.
Right.
That when we take an element like hydrogen, and we take an element like oxygen, and we look at them, there's no possible way that we would ever figure out by that combining these two would create water, and that water could then put out fire. That the super additive consequence of our consciousness and the super consciousness building the soul gives us this, what we would call three dimensions, but gives us now 70 dimensions. We go to movies and look at 3D movies, and we think, well, what would it be like to have 70 different senses? Wow.
Well, I know. That's an amazing thought, and yet it says this is so, and this is just the first tune-up. This is the first Mirantra body we're given when we are resurrected on the mansion worlds. And, you know, here, again, it says that there is a resurrection hall, and it has radial wings, and the different races from the different worlds, and all of these inhabited worlds. And yes, the Urantia book says there are that the universe is teeming with life, and there are myriads of inhabited worlds. And
we
so
are definitely not the only inhabited world in the universe.
Right, definitely not. And if ever I found evidence of intelligence on beyond this planet, the Urantia book is it. It's the best evidence I've ever found that there
best,
is an intelligence.
Best explanation, that's for sure.
Without a doubt. But so, you know, we wake up over there, and it tells us that the angels have, our angels have helped in this whole process to hold our soul and reconstitute it on the other side. And we get back together with that fragment that is God, and he holds all of our memories and our identity. And the angels hold our soul, and they reconstitute it over there. It's like they mix the ingredients back together, and there we are. We're back. We are as we were. Poof. And we wake up, we open our eyes, and I imagine the first thing you'll see is your angel smiling at you, right? Just like you saw your mom and dad smiling at you when you came into this world. The first
thing
you'll
see. One of the authors says, you will never, ever, in all of eternity, forget that moment.
Resurrection morning.
That resurrection
Whereas
moment.
Whereas we can't remember the morning we were or the day
yeah.
that we were born.
My mother does.
This will be something we will remember forever.
Well,
right.
And that's something your mother will never forget in all eternity,
that's
probably.
Right.
But
yeah.
Even if you don't remember it, your mother will never forget it, or your father will never forget it. And so there we are. We're with our angels. We open our eyes. We orient ourselves to the fact that we still are. And now we have a whole new world to explore. And not only that, we have 7 worlds.
Yeah,
seven
I was going to say, that's important. One of the quotes I want to read is, says that Gerizim, the headquarters of our local system, has 7 worlds of transition culture, each of which is encircled by 7 satellites, among which are the 7 mansion worlds of Mirantia detention. And that's something
I
else
never
that,
that word.
You know, it does say that basically the work we do on the mansion worlds is almost all remediation. It's all making up for what we didn't do here, what we didn't get here. If we had been born on a more stabilized, normalized sort of planet, we might go transition through the mansion worlds very rapidly. But anyway, it goes on to say that that there are 7 mansion worlds of Mirantia detention, man's first post-mortal residence. As the term heaven has been used on Urantia, and for those who don't know, Urantia is the name that the book gives for this world, for Earth. The term heaven has been used on Urantia. It has sometimes meant these seven mansion worlds. The first mansion world being denominated the first heaven, and so on to the seventh. We also end up with Urantia guides. And these are beings that are, they're sort of like graduate students who are helping to guide us through our life experience on each of these worlds.
Right.
And it says that on the mansion worlds, after your vision range is extended and you are freed from the fetters of material comparisons, you can begin to comprehend the meaning of those realities which eye cannot see nor ear hear. So that's kind of where I got the idea that maybe we can hear people's thoughts, which have never entered the concept of human minds. Even those things which God has prepared for those who love such eternal verities. You are not always to be so limited in the range of your vision and spiritual comprehension.
And, you know, imagine that, then you realize that you are, that you still are. And I want to point out that, you know, you mentioned the remedial training spheres, the seven mansion worlds. And again, the Bible gives us a clue. Jesus said, in my Father's house are many mansions. I go there to prepare a place for you, right? So we know that even Jesus mentioned, you know, when he says, I have other sheep, not of this flock. He was mentioning these other inhabited worlds. He wasn't talking about North America. He was talking about other sheep, not of this human flock, other flocks on other worlds. My Father has many mansions in his house, other worlds. And you know, so this concept that this world is troubled, I hope that that's not any big surprise to any of our listeners. We live on a troubled world. Our world has had many setbacks. We are not normal.
I think we can safely say that we're probably one of the most retarded worlds.
We probably are. And the Rancher book explains exactly why that is. That's why anybody should read it, because if you want to understand the human condition, why we are the way we are and how we got here, nothing explains that like the Urantia book.
Well,
so these
I think
seven...
that's why the Urantia papers have arrived at this particular time. I think, first of all, it is determined that we are ready for this
right.
kind of information, but
absolutely.
We're also in a philosophical crisis on our planet that is causing these wars and this disruption, and it's eating up the resources of our planet that could be put to such better uses, and that it's time to bring it to a stop. And the only thing that's going to help that is a more expansive view of how it all works and our piece of that puzzle, that our
right.
position in the universe, individually, collectively, and as a planet.
Right.
And moving on to the concept
just before you move
too,
on, could I just interrupt for 1 minute? I have to leave. I've got an appointment. So I just thought I'd better sign off of it before we go down another
well, thank
route.
Thank you, Gumshoe.
Thanks for
hey,
joining us.
Keep on the
thank
trail,
you,
okay?
Thank you, Paula. I love you both very much. And,
love you, too.
I'll talk to you sometime this week, Paula, and you guys have a great show, and I will listen to the end on the archive.
Okay.
Terrific.
Keep up the good work.
Okay,
have a great week.
So long to everybody on the chat room. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye for now, Gumshoe.
It says that planetary mortals are all animal origin evolutionary beings of ascendant potential. In origin, nature, and destiny, these various groups, meaning, you know, the other inhabited worlds, races from other inhabited worlds, these various groups and types of human beings are not wholly unlike the Urantia people. The human races of each world receive the same ministry of God, sons of God, and enjoy the presence of the ministering spirits of time. After natural death, all types of ascenders fraternize as one Marantia family on the mansion world. So that's another thing that we're going to need to get used to. There's another place in the book where it states quite plainly, if we think we have difficulty getting along with the variety of races on this world, just wait.
Just wait. You know,
it's
what?
It's going to become more challenging.
We have a good friend, and again, here is this concept. Jesus again said, lay up your treasures in heaven, for where your treasures are, there also will your heart be. So you know, we know, because from the Urantia book, and if we thought about it, we'd probably know this, that our treasures are our relationships. They are eternal.
And our character development.
Right. Our experiences, our understanding, our knowledge, our personal power, whether that be our personal gifts, right? These are endowments that we get to keep, that we get to take. If we develop them, they last. They last beyond this life. And so, you know, when we think of human relationships, all too often we think of them as being disposable, like they don't go on. They do. They do go on. And one of the things that we might be doing in the next life in these remedial training spheres that the Urantia book calls the mansion worlds is learning how to get those relationships right.
There's something else that we have working for us. They say this is something that is working for us, not against us. But we will no longer have the capacity to procrastinate. And there's a type of being who's assigned to helping us deal with time as a vital factor.
Mm.
In our process, our decision-making, and our achieving choices. So I think there are probably going to be some things that will require certain adjustments. But one of the other things it tells us is that we pretty much start off there, right where we left off here.
Right.
We're not going to make any major jumps in our character development, in our experiential growth, in our, you know, wisdom or our achievements. Like if there are things that we have difficulties with here, various types of work or processes, you know, we will have to work on those in the future.
Just like we have to work on them now. I mean, and you know, we're ahead of the game if we start to, the Urantia book says in one place, start to think of yourself as an eternal person now. Start to realize that you have value and substance that goes on beyond death. And start to work on yourself, your character. And start to focus on those realities that make you real.
Well, and one
reality.
Of the things it says, for example, is that trustworthiness is the true measure of self-mastery and
mm-hmm.
character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trustworthiness is one of the things it says is really primary to character. There's another place where it says that the betrayal of trust, of betraying a trusted friend, is seen as one of the most heinous sins in the universe. It doesn't say that it's unforgivable, but it just really, really
it's crucial. It's you know, it says nothing is more destructive of your personality status than the betrayal of trust.
And there are even a form of ministering spirit that we will encounter called The Solemnity of Trust.
Right.
And I'm going to just take a little pause here to read more about that because it's such a crucial issue. It says, The Solemnity of Trust. Trust is the crucial test of will creatures. Trustworthiness is the true measure of self-mastery and character. Mm-hmm. These Sakonafim, this angelic type of being, accomplish a double purpose in the economy of the superuniverse. They portray to all will creatures the sense of the obligation, sacredness, and solemnity of trust. At the same time, they unerringly reflect to the governing authorities the exact trustworthiness of any candidate for confidence or trust. I'm going to read on just the next paragraph.
Yeah.
On Urantia, you grotesquely essay to read character and to estimate specific abilities. But on Uversa, we actually do these things in perfection. These Sakonafim weigh trustworthiness in the living scales of unerring character appraisal. And when they have looked at you, we have only to look at them to know the limitations of your ability to discharge responsibility, execute trust, and fulfill missions. Your assets of trustworthiness are clearly set forth alongside your liabilities of possible default or betrayal.
You know, the reality is that you can't hide from God. You can't hide from the universe. And you know, what you are, even what you think, is known. There's nowhere to hide.
Goes on, though, to say that to overload an individual only courts disaster and ensures disappointment. The mistake of placing responsibility prematurely upon either man or angel may be avoided by utilizing the ministry of these infallible estimators of the trust capacity of individuals of time and space. So there's a lot of mercy credits that we have, and the realization that we are all spiritually incredibly immature here and in the next life. So you get the sense that we're supposed to learn by experience, and we're supposed to learn by making mistakes. So we have a lot of forgiveness, a lot of mercy for the natural error-prone nature of our human self.
Sorry about the phone.
Your fax machine just goes off, and there's not much you can do about it.
No, I usually try to put it on mute, but since it's just you and me, I don't want to leave you hanging out there. So I just have to ignore the phone sometimes, friends. I'm sitting here in the fellowship office, and we get phone calls.
What are some of the other things that you really find amazing about the Urantia story?
You know, here is the whole concept that it is designed to help you grow spiritually. Everything is set up to help you grow spiritually. And there's key concepts, like you said. Trustworthiness is a big one. We can start working on that now. Faith in the things that we can't see. This idea that angels are there helping us, this idea that, we never are alone. We wake up on the mansion world and we're assigned a Urantia companion, a companion that will go through the whole experience with us. We don't have to try to figure things out on our own. We have ever-ready, present help.
We have our guardian angel.
We just don't realize that we do. But here's one of my favorite quotes, and this just gives you a little flavor. It's from, again, the Urantia Life, which is an explanation in the Urantia Book of Life After Death, and some of the spiritual helpers we have, and this particular group of angels inspire us to serve. And unselfish service is another part of God's economy, just like trustworthiness. This is why the whole economy of the universe of universes works, because of service and trustworthiness and integrity, the fruits of the Spirit. That's what keeps us all moving forward and progressing. So this is what we learn from these angels. And this is just so poignant. It's some of their wisdom. I call it angelic wisdom. It says, from them you will learn to let pressure develop stability and certainty, to be faithful and earnest and withal cheerful, to accept challenges without complaint, and to face difficulties and uncertainties without fear. They will ask, if you fail, will you rise indomitably to try anew? If you succeed, will you maintain a well-balanced poise, a stabilized and spiritualized attitude throughout every effort in the long struggle to break the fetters of material inertia, to attain the freedom of spirit existence? Even as mortals, so have these angels been father to many disappointments, and they will point out that sometimes your most disappointing disappointments have become your greatest blessings. Sometimes the planting of a seed necessitates its death, the death of your fondest hopes, before it can be reborn to bear the fruits of new life and new opportunity. And from them you will learn to suffer less through sorrow and disappointment, first by making fewer personal plans concerning other personalities.
I love that. That's one of my favorite quotes in the whole book.
All women love that one.
In fact, I think it bears repeating. Why don't you reread that?
Okay. And from them, the angels, you will learn to suffer less through sorrow and disappointment, first by making fewer personal plans concerning other personalities, and then by accepting your lot when you have faithfully performed your duty. You will learn that you increase your burdens and decrease the likelihood of success by taking yourself too seriously. Nothing can take the precedence over the work of your status sphere, this world or the next. Very important is the work of preparation for the next higher sphere, but nothing equals the importance of the work of the world in which you are actually living. But though the work is important, the self is not. When you feel important, you lose energy to the wear and tear of ego dignity, so that there is little energy left to do the work. Self-importance, not work importance, exhausts immature creatures. It is the self-element that exhausts, not the effort to achieve. You can do important work if you do not become self-important. You can do several things as easily as one if you leave yourself out. Variety is restful. Monotony is what wears and exhausts. Day after day is alike, just life or the alternative of death. That's just a little taste of, one section of what you will learn from the angels. This particular group is called the Ministering Reserves, and they take delight in service, and even when they're not assigned, they love to serve, and they love to ignite the spirit of service in volunteers. So that's just a sense, that gives you a sense of the cosmic university that we're all a part of, and that we keep growing and continuing beyond this world. We don't gain all that we have to gain in this life, and then we die and poof, it's all gone. It was all for naught. A big cosmic joke. No.
The other thing that we're told is that we have training worlds beyond the seven mansion worlds. There are 70 training spheres beyond the seven that we begin on. And each of these training worlds all have a specific focus or function. And, another thing I wanted to mention is that approximately 1,000 worlds, 1,000 inhabited planets, will all be using the same seven mansion worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a feeling that there's going to that the socialization experience is going to be a very important part of our mansion world experience. We need to learn how to live with and get along with and work with and serve with many different types of people.
Right. And you know, here we have, and it goes back to, so many of the lessons we learn in this life are so basic to the next life and to our continuing existence. And I know if Andre were here, he'd probably love to tell us about the univitation, how, and I think he's mentioned it on past shows, how we spend quite a bit of time with these beings that are so different from us, and we really learn patience and acceptance and
tolerance.
You know, from these other beings. And certainly when we wake up over there, we realize that, boy, we really had a lot in common with the people from our world.
We're a lot more in common than we realized.
We're from this little island in space that we call Earth.
The other thing that is very moving to me and that I think we could learn a lot from here, that we could start utilizing here, is that it says, as the ascending mortals progress from the lower to the higher of the Marantia worlds, they serve on countless assignments in association with their teachers and in company with their more advanced and senior brethren. And what I get from that is sort of almost everything seems to work like in an apprenticeship kind of process,
mm-hmm.
where the people who have just learned something are directly involved with teaching those who are in that in the process of learning that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not expected to figure everything out on our own.
No.
And rather than competing with each other in the way we do here in school, we're really a lot more in line with collaborating and cooperating with each other. And it also says in another place in the Arantia book that children learn far better from other children who are just ahead of them than they will from adult teachers. And I think this is really an important lesson for us to learn.
Absolutely. We play the role of students and teachers throughout our whole universe career.
And we don't have postdoctoral professors teaching kindergarten students.
Right. It's much more powerful coming from the group that just learned that lesson.
Indeed.
You know? We just had a caller who dropped off. Caller, give us a call back. He wasn't on very long, but...
What area code was
back.
It?
It was a Skype call, 111.
Oh, okay.
I was just about to grab the call, and it dropped off. Maybe he lost the call. But if you want to give us a call back in, go ahead. Our number is 646-716-8158. We're talking about life after death and the reality of life after death and what the Arantia book claims to say about these things. Of course, we know the Arantia book claims to be a revelation of truth to our world from a friendly and well-ordered universe. And there's no author attached to the book, at least no human author, and it constitutes a tremendous and wonderful mystery, one that Crispolin and I have read and Gumshoe has read, and many of you on the board have read it and studied it for years. The more we read it, the more sense it makes, the more beautiful its teachings become, and it just does make so much sense. That's the beauty of it. And it's liberating. You know, I said earlier in the show, Jesus said, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And, you know, we've heard that in our religious upbringings. But you got to wonder, how will the truth free you? And a lot of people, I got to tell you, a lot of people have come up and told me, now, the truth is, Paula, you're going to hell. I'm like, oh, how is that making setting me free.
Well, if anyone is, Paula, it would have to be you.
Oh, I got emails just this week. Y'all are going to hell. And
well,
fortunately,
we don't have to be afraid of that. One of the other wonderful benefits and one of the other great pieces of good news in this book is that there is no hell.
Right. So here's the other part of the fear of dying. Is this fear that you're going to hell? Oh, my gosh. What
I've made some unforgivable error in this lifetime, and that's it for me. I'm going to spend the rest of eternity burning in
paying
hell.
Paying for that. And
by a
you
God
know,
that Jesus said was loving.
Right.
How does that fit together? Anyway, we are down to our last 15 minutes of the show.
Well,
Once again, the time has buzzed by, so let's get back on topic.
I want to share this quote with you, Krislyn, because it's so great. It's just so beautiful, and it touches right on that concept of hell. And this is from paper 188. It's in the Jesus Papers. It's called The Time of the Tomb. And this is Midway Commentary, I believe, which is like they're just such amazing authors. They say, when once you grasp the idea of God as a true and loving Father, the only concept which Jesus ever taught, you must forthwith, in all consistency, utterly abandon all those primitive notions of God as an offended monarch, a stern and all-powerful ruler whose chief delight is to detect his subjects in wrongdoing and to see that they are adequately punished, unless some being almost equal to himself should volunteer to suffer for them, to die as a substitute and in their stead. The whole idea of ransom and atonement is incompatible with the concept of God as it was taught and exemplified by Jesus of Nazareth. The infinite love of God is not secondary to anything in the divine nature. And then it says early on in the book, God the Father transcends God the Judge. You know, certainly God is justice, and justice is precise.
But when you read the Urantia Book version of justice, you get a very different idea about it, because it says that the time lag of justice is perpetuated throughout the super universe, and that the beings that might sit in judgment of us take an incredible amount of time to give us every opportunity to atone or rectify or to be genuinely sorry for the errors we make. And we really have to be totally committed to our own soul destruction before we are allowed to be destroyed. And the Urantia Book states that the wages of sin or the wages of iniquity is death, which means that it's simply the cessation of existence.
Right.
There is no greater punishment than being just simply to stop existing.
It's like a vine that cuts it, that would separate from the branch, a branch that would separate from the vine. How can a vine survive or a branch survive except that it's attached to the vine? If the branch disattaches from the vine, then the source of life that keeps the branch alive is gone. The branch has cut itself off from that, and that's essentially, it's just that obvious. I mean, you can't live without the source that sustains you. God is the source of life. You can't live without God. God is the source of your life. But here's another quote, and just let me share this. This is just one more paragraph, and it's from Jesus, the Sojourn at Tyre and Sidon, paper 156. He says, "Do not become discouraged by the discovery that you are human. Human nature may tend toward evil, but it is not inherently sinful. Be not downcast by your failure wholly to forget some of your regrettable experiences. The mistakes which you fail to forget in time will be forgotten in eternity. Lighten your burdens of soul by speedily acquiring a long-distance view of your destiny, a universe expansion of your career. Make not the mistake of estimating the soul's worth by the imperfections of the mind or by the appetites of the body. Judge not the soul, nor evaluate its destiny by the standard of a single unfortunate human episode. Your spiritual destiny is conditioned only by your spiritual longings and purposes." Those words are like water to my soul. Because what human down here doesn't agonize over the mistakes they've made? You know, doesn't agonize over the regrettable experiences they've had. And yet, Jesus himself is saying, "Hey, kid, let it go. It's okay. You're human. No big surprise to all of us in the universe. We knew you were human. We know you're not perfect. You don't have to be perfect. We love you just the way you are." Has anybody in your life ever told you that? And how much does that mean to be loved just the way you are? You don't have to prove anything. Just desire to do better. We just want you to try to do better. That's all. That, to me, is, there's so much forgiveness in that, and so much love, and so much tolerance.
So beautiful.
For our human condition, that we go on. And it's not just what we do in this life. It's what we do in the next life and the life after that. It all matters.
Well, and we really do need to mention here, too, that at some point, between our mortal death here and before reaching our local universe headquarters, we will have the opportunity to make a permanent decision about whether or not we want to continue on this universe plan. And at the point at which we permanently choose God as our direction, as our guide, as our pilot, as our moral compass, we have the most amazing opportunity to actually merge with that pre-personal particle of God which resides within our mind that is called the thought adjuster. And when we do fuse with this thought adjuster, we become one.
Mm-hmm.
And that constitutes us becoming eternal beings, permanently on the target gravity circuit towards paradise. And once we have fused with that thought adjuster, our success is guaranteed.
It's a classic marriage. It really is a classic marriage of a betrothal between that fragment of God that dwells within us and us, our soul. And a woman asked me if I talk to that fragment of God within me on a daily basis. And I said, and I'll just read you what I responded to her. I said, I speak and pray to my Father within all the time. In fact, as much as possible, I try to remember that He is privy to all of my thoughts, so I strive to consciously direct them to Him. He knows that most of the time I'm trying to figure things out, and more than anything, I'm trying to figure personalities out. I ask Him to help me understand, especially those who think so differently from the way I do. I don't feel I need to always think lofty thoughts for His sake. He knows me too well for that. I can't hide my real self from Him. But I also know that He craves to share the experience of growth, evolution, and the inner life with me. I offer Him release from infinite perfection. We all do. And He, in turn, is my ever-ready guide to infinite perfection. It's a classic marriage. I give Him personality, He gives me identity. I give Him my experience of life, and He gives me a way to make the most of that experience. I hope that makes sense. My beloved is in my breath. As I look back over my life, I can see so clearly His helping hand. I can feel Him in me, in my heart, so strong, so good, so present. I get in His way all too often, but if I get out of His way, He moves through me and uses me in amazing and wonderful ways, ways that I myself am astonished by.
That's lovely. Just lovely.
That reality that you're talking about, Crystalline, that is so dear and precious, so unspeakably good, that the Urantia book gives us this sense that God is always with us.
Indeed.
Always present.
And on the topic of judgment and also the fusion process that I mentioned earlier, I want to read one more quote from the Urantia book from Paper 5, Section 1, Paragraph 11. It says, "Mortal man may draw near God and may repeatedly forsake the divine will, so long as the power of choice remains. Man's final doom is not sealed until he has lost the power to choose the Father's will. There is never a closure of the Father's heart to the need and the petition of His children. Only do His offspring close their hearts forever to the Father's drawing power when they finally and forever lose the desire to do His divine will, to know Him and to be like Him. Likewise is man's eternal destiny assured when a juster fusion proclaims to the universe that such an ascender has made the final and irrevocable choice to live the Father's will."
Mm-hmm.
And for any of you who are listening, when we started the show and I shared about my own life, earthly father sharing some of these concepts with me. One of the things he shared along with that story was that to live the Father's will would be the most exciting, the most adventurous,
right,
the most fulfilling, and the most amazing outcome that goes beyond what we could even imagine. It's not some kind of dreary drudgery or something that leaves us eternally on a path of isolated loneliness or discouraging boredom. It's really quite the opposite. It's really the most amazing thing we could ever imagine. Better than anything we could ever imagine.
Right, better than anything. The truth is better than anything we could ever imagine. And so, my friends, we're at the end of our show now, and I hope that we've given you some food for thought, some hope that you don't gain all that you gain in this life and it's all for naught. We hope that we've helped you overcome a little bit of your fear of death, if that's what it is, or you're grieving for losing someone you loved. This is just the beginning, this life is, and we go on from here.
And we get to see each other again.
Right. We do get to see each other again.
For us, it might feel like a long time. But for those on the other side, it's just almost a blip in time.
That's right. Timeless and spaceless. It's as if no time or space ever came between you.
So join us again next week. We may continue this discussion if Andre wishes to. There's still a lot more to cover.
Yeah,
so
still a lot.
We will
keep you
posted.
Yeah. And for more information about the Urantia Book, go to www.urantiabook.org. And our thanks to the Urantia Book Fellowship for sponsoring this show, and we hope you tune in next week. And until then,
bye for now.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book, so all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.